This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today are Elizabeth Lanier Fennell, who is the founder of Girls Really Into Shooting, or GRITS, Rebecca Darwin, who is the co-founder and CEO of Garden and Gun Magazine, and Amanda Heckert, who is the editor of a book that Garden and Gun is responsible for called Southern Women, More Than 100 Stories of Innovators, Artists, and Icons. With that introduction, ladies, welcome to the journal.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Rebecca, we'll start off with you and a little bit about Garden and Gun and why you decided to do this project.
Sure. Garden and Gun is 13 years old this year. It's hard for me to believe. I kind of have to pinch myself. But 13 years ago, decided that there really was a need for a magazine that talked to a different kind of Southerner, somebody who loved the South but was into more than just the food or the music, but also the writing and the culture and all of those things. So started Garden and Gun, and from the very beginning of this magazine, it's always been about storytelling, telling the stories of people and the things that they like to do. And you know, in the South, we're never going to run out of stories. So we intend to be going for a long, long time. But initially, I always thought that the magazine was going to be more than just a magazine, that there would be lots of other things that we could do with what now we refer to as the brand, the lifestyle brand. And books was always a piece of that. Our editor-in-chief, Dave DiBenedetto, had written a book, so I knew that he knew more about book publishing than I did. And initially, we thought we would do a book on The Good Dog, which is a regular column in the magazine that everybody loves. But we started working with a publisher, and so the first book that we did was our Southerner's Handbook. Then we did The Good Dog. Then we did The Southerner's Cookbook. And then we did kind of an encyclopedia of Southern culture called S's for Southern. And we women decided it was time to do something specifically about Southern women. We had actually done a feature in the magazine back in 2011 about Southern women that was really, really well received. And so that was kind of the genesis of this whole idea. But then it evolved further. And so this is our fifth book. Three of those books have been on the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, you wrote an introduction about your grandmothers and their influence. And you made a point of dealing with stereotypes of Southern women, you know, Scarlett, Melanie, Delilah, what have you.
Yes, there are stereotypes for sure. I think one of the things that I also mentioned in that little introduction was about my time that I spent in New York City and how people would always be asking you, isn't it really hard being a Southerner in New York City, like we were little cream puffs, you know, and that we couldn't take the heat. You know, I would kind of brush it off when I was living there. But when I came back to South Carolina now 15 years ago, I realized that my Southernness was something really good for me. You know, it did make me perhaps have to be a little bit tougher and show people that I could make it. But I didn't really think about that when I was there. But I think, you know, my little piece is called Grit and Grace. And I think that Southern women, for the most part, really combine those two things. We know how to kind of sweeten our asks. But we also have, we come from a background where we're really full of grit. And there's so many examples of women like that in this book. So, you know, yes, some of them are maybe a little bit more on the Southern belle side of things. But I think if you scratch the surface just a little bit, you're going to find a lot of that grit or grits underneath.
All right. And Amanda, you had the task, did you not, of selecting the 100 women. You've had hundreds of women or stories about women in Garden and Gun, and not to mention those that have not appeared there. So how did you come up with the list?
It was a challenge, but it was exciting to think about who we wanted to include. Certainly, you know, as you mentioned, since our inception, we've told the stories of strong Southern women, from the conservationist Laura Turner Saadell in our very first issue to, in our latest, the singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens. And, you know, certainly there were women that we featured over the years that we knew we wanted to sort of plumb deeper with and hear more of their story, especially, you know, know, having them wrestle with this idea of what it means to be Southern and what it means to be a Southern woman. And so, you know, I did a lot of research myself, but I also canvassed, you know, our contributors and other writers and other people across the South for ideas about who to include, because I didn't want it just to come from my point of view or even just the staff of Garden and Gun's point of view, but I wanted to make sure that we were casting that net wide to, you know, we were talking about stereotypes. I really wanted to show all of the many ways that you can be a Southern woman today and what it means to be a Southern woman today.
All right. How did you define the South? How did you decide whether a person's born here, where a person has been sadly born somewhere else, but she has made her life and had a great impression on the South? How did you decide that?
I think most of the people, you know, with Garden and Gun, we take a pretty a liberal view of the South. We go all the way from Texas up to D.C. and Maryland. And, you know, I think some of those people may or may not consider themselves Southerners. Certainly Texans consider themselves Texans first. But, you know, most of the women have roots in the South, were born here. But certainly if someone had been here long enough that they identified as a Southerner, no matter, you know, sort of where they were born or had sort of a transformative experience here in the South, we counted them.
Okay. And how large was your first list?
Oh, gosh. Oh, I would say it was several hundred women. And again, we cast the net wide and made a lot of requests. You know, some people we asked, you know, couldn't do it for, you know, scheduling reasons or that sort of thing. But, you know, mostly the women were excited to take part and be able to share their point of views and perspectives. You know, we have a wide range of women. You have icons and stars from Sissy Spacek and Reese Witherspoon, Octavia Spencer, to women whose maybe stories have been undertold. You know, I think about the groundbreaking Texas rancher Minnie Lou Bradley or the G's Bend quilter and arts advocate Mary Margaret Petway. These are all women who, in our view, have made their mark not just on Southern culture, but really on America itself.
That brings me to Elizabeth Lanier Fennell, who was one of those women. And Elizabeth, I did not know who you were before I read the book. But see, we could only have one other guest on the show. I tabbed a number of women whose stories grabbed me and were interesting. And yours actually was at the top of the list. You were the first person that we asked, Rebecca, to see if we could get you on the show.
Thank you very much.
So let's tell your story, how you got started, and of course your acronym is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. That's our tongue in cheek. The way I got started personally was I gave my ex-husband shooting lessons, and he was a wing shooter, and somebody suggested clay targets, and so I gave him lessons. I gave him a package of five lessons, and I went with him to the first one, and the instructor there insisted that I shoot, and I was like, oh, I don't think I want to do this, and he said, come on and just give it a try. You'll love it. And he was right. I did. And so I proceeded to take the next four lessons that I had given him and then continued to take them. And I had three kids, and I would drive up in my Suburban, and they'd have Happy Meals and car seats, and I'd put the movie on in the truck and go take an hour shooting lesson and get back in, and they'd all be asleep, and I'd drive home, and all was well in the world.
All right. Well, then you're doing that for pleasure. Did you ever start participating in competitions?
I did some side-by-side competitions. I shot as I could, but I had young children, and we got invited to go on a driven shoot in Scotland in 2006.
All right. Now describe that. A driven shoot.
A driven shoot. So you go and you have a line of eight guns, and you have what they call pegs, and you have a loader behind you, and in front of you, you have beaters, and they drive birds towards you, and they fly over your heads, and hopefully you shoot them and hit them, and then they have people with dogs behind you that retrieve the birds back to hand. And it's absolutely extraordinary to watch the whole, these are 100-year-old traditions, and to watch the beaters work and the dogs work and all that's quite fascinating. And when I got back, I was just hooked on shooting.
Okay. But how did that become transformed into your business?
When I got back from Scotland, I really enjoyed it. And I thought this would be something really fun to do maybe 2 days a month or something while my children were in school. And so I called a couple of the women who went on the trip, and we all agreed to meet at a local gun club. And none of us were particularly good, but we just thought it was good therapy and good fun to get together and do it. So we went, we shot, we would invite some other women, and we decided to make it a monthly thing. And in the process of that, we needed to come up with a name. So it was just tongue-in-cheek. And this was in Richmond, Virginia. And we would get together and call ourselves the Grits, and we would shoot, and we'd have a glass of port afterwards or cheese, and then we'd go home and agree to the next month's shoot. And so in the competition spirit, we decided to attend an event called the Southern Side-by-Side. And I had a big stretch golf cart, and we put a banner on the back that said Grits, and we had our stereo going. And we went around that course, and everybody knew who we were, and everybody wanted to be part of it. And they saw us having a good time, and we had a great tailgate party afterwards. And the next year, we did the same thing, and people started coming up to us and saying, hey, we want to do that, and we want to be a part of that. How can we do that? And I always thought, gosh, that's a gargantuan undertaking. I don't think I can do that at this time. But what it compelled me to do was I thought, if I'm going to guide these women, I need to know how to teach them. And so I went to get my level one teaching certification.
GRITS is an acronym for?
Girls Really Into Shooting.
And how did you, or where do you go to get your certification as a gun instructor?
The National Sporting Clay Associations have different people that will certify you. In my case, I went to Deep River in Sanford, North Carolina, and was certified by a gentleman named Bill Kempfer. And you get your level one, and then you have to teach 400 hours. The requirements have probably changed. And then you could go to level two after 2 years. And then 1,200 hours later, you can go to level three. And so I went all the way. Eventually.
Okay. And you conduct this back home in Sharon, South Carolina?
I taught in Richmond for 8 years, and then I remarried and moved to Sharon, South Carolina.
Okay.
And
okay.
We do it there in the Kew Island Gun Club.
Okay. Well, that is an interesting story. And Amanda, how did you find about Elizabeth and Grits?
Well, I heard about Elizabeth through Rebecca, and I know, you know, events over the years. But what appealed to me, too, was a word that sort of came up over and over again as we were doing this project was, you know, what makes a Southern woman? And certainly a lot of people said strong, but, you know, I like to take it a step further and say resilient. And Elizabeth's story to me is one of resilience and also empowerment. You know, in the book, she tells a great story about how her friends who have come to her and participated in Grits have really, it's really given them confidence.
Yes, a lot. And women who didn't think they could do so many things, not just shoot shotguns, but it transcends into other parts of their lives where they say, oh, wow, I can do this. I'm stronger than I think, and I'm more able than I believed in myself.
Well, did you grow up shooting?
I did not.
Okay. I don't hunt any longer, but I did, and we used to have a place in the country. And when my girls were 8 and 10, I had a 20-gauge, and we lived in the country, and I taught them how to shoot a shotgun. They didn't particularly care about hunting, but we also lived in the wilds, and so I said, you need to know how to handle it. And they both did. They didn't take to beyond that, but it was an experience that people said, you know, you taught girls. Well, they're my daughters, and they're there.
I would say something about Elizabeth because I have shot with her, and we've just formed a Grits group in Charleston, South Carolina. But I think that what Elizabeth has done for women in shooting is take the intimidation out of it and make it fun. And I think that really is, she's made so much progress because of that, because I think so many women are, if they, oh, well, I can't do that, you know, and I think she breaks it down for them and really has turned a lot of women on to a growing sport.
Well, and of course, then you have to deal with images. It's in the woods, and it's dirty, and it's nasty, and you delicate thing, you shouldn't be in a duck blind, or
I think you're
all smiling. You've all heard this.
Well, yeah, I think.
But we like it.
I think that what women that have come to me to learn to shoot were most afraid of was the kick, the noise. You know, is it going to hurt? Because that's all they've ever heard. And when they're taught to do it correctly, to hold the shotgun correctly and how to do it, and they're given the right shell and the right gun for their individual needs, it's a remarkable experience. It doesn't have to be any of those things. The only time that I ever shot as a child was at a 4th of July celebration or something, and I remember a great uncle of mine gave me the first shotgun that I ever had, and I was about 13, and I never really used it, but it was a Franchi, or some people say Franchi, 20-gauge, and it was a semi-automatic, and it about knocked my head off, but I was not going to give in to that. I was not going to let anybody know that it did. but anyway, he told me he could shoot it off of his nose, and I told him it'd break it. But I think a lot of times women who have been introduced really young or as young girls have had a bad experience, and so you have to take that bad experience and turn it into something good.
Well, our listeners in South Carolina, if they wanted to shoot clays, where would they go?
Around Charleston, there are several places. Kiowa has a club that has a sporting clays course. There's a place called Partridge Creek, kind of near Somerville, and then a place called Bluefield that has just opened up near Walterboro. So that in our area, I don't know specifically.
There's some big clubs just an hour south of Charlotte. There's Rocky Creek. There's Backwoods Quail Club. There's Camden Hermitage Farms. It's Joe Canty. He's pretty legendary as well. There are lots of gun clubs in South Carolina.
All right. Well, I think that's something for people to know. And one more thing, Elizabeth. When Amanda called you, did she call, you call or write? How did you get in touch?
I think I sent her an email first, but I actually did conduct the interview for the book with Elizabeth.
Well, you know, Elizabeth, you get this email. What's your reaction?
Oh, I was tickled. I was very honored. I think that I couldn't believe it. You don't do things expecting things like this. I don't, but I was very humbled. I was very honored to be asked to be a part of it.
And you weren't embarrassed to tell your story?
Oh, absolutely not.
No, I mean—
Tenacious. You've got to be tenacious. Southern women are tenacious.
Ladies, we need to pause for a moment and let folks know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Lanier Fennell, Amanda Heckert, and Rebecca Darwin about Southern Women, a book published by Garden and Gun. Okay, hard question to ask. Everybody has a favorite. Okay, I've already told you that I had lots of favorites, and I picked Elizabeth out as the person that I wanted to have on the show. You've read the book, Elizabeth. Who of your peers in that book really grabbed you?
There were several women in here whose stories really grabbed me. One was Tig Notaro. Mm-hmm. I thought she had a fascinating story, and there were lots of women in here whose stories. There was an older woman who was a cattle.
Minnie Bradley.
She was fascinating.
All right. Well, Rebecca, can you and Amanda help tell those two ladies' stories?
Sure. Minnie Lou Bradley is a groundbreaking rancher in Texas. She's originally from Oklahoma, and she was the first woman to major in animal husbandry at Oklahoma State University, which was then Oklahoma A&M. First female president of the American Angus Association and a member of the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. And I ran across Minnie Lou's story from a publicist who works with the Angus Association. What was really remarkable to me about her, obviously ranching is a very male-dominated field, and she tells in her story about how she had to prove herself to get into, you know, competing when she was at the university. And, you know, she's just a really great storyteller. She talked about, the interviewer asked her, what's the biggest challenge you've faced? And she says, you know, I guess you're getting around to the fact that I was doing this in a man's world. And she said, you know, I would have to earn my way in. When I asked them, can I be a part of this? They were all men, and every one of them said, if you're good enough. And she said, that's the way it's always been. And she was clearly good enough.
I think it's interesting, the two people that Elizabeth mentioned were also, we had done an issue of the magazine about a year before where we went from a young girl up to, Minnie was I think the next to the last in terms of age. Leah Chase, the restaurateur from New Orleans, was in her 90s at that time, and has since unfortunately passed away. But it was very interesting because we had, you know, a woman from each of the decades, which really kind of was our testing ground again for doing this book. But that's another thing that I think is so great about the book is that it's young, it's old. We also, the magazine typically has six pillars, and I won't run through all of them, but the book very much is also based on that. So it's women who are in the food business, women who are in the sporting life, women who are into the entertainment business, so arts and culture. So we really tried to not only cover all ages, but kind of all aspects of, and then again, also to cover the region completely, which is something that we try to do in the magazine all the time, and not just focus on one area.
Elizabeth also mentioned Tig Notaro.
Yes, Tig is a comedian and actor, and she is from Mississippi. You may have seen her series that she did called One Mississippi, and it was sort of based on her childhood there. You know, she just has a really inspiring story in that she's had these obstacles. Again, that idea and theme of resilience that she's overcome. In fact, she had both a near-fatal intestinal infection and breast cancer in 2012, and, you know, it sort of turned that into part of her stand-up routine and sort of took that story and, you know, was able to really affect people with it. And she's just a really funny, wonderful actor, too.
Okay. Well, Rebecca, one category you didn't mention, and I've got about three people in that category, innovators and iconoclasts, particularly those who were breaking stereotypes.
Yes.
Right and left. And, of course, one of those I tabbed was, of course, Darla Moore.
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, she's been top of mind for me because I had the opportunity to interview Darla in Atlanta. We are doing a series with Synovus Bank and to speaking to women. And we held this down in Atlanta at our club, the Garden and Gun Club, our restaurant that we opened a couple of years ago. But I was fascinated because I compared many of the things that are the same about Darla and me and our paths and growing up in South Carolina. And her father was a teacher. My father was a teacher. Moving to New York, coming back to the South. But what made it so interesting to me was that when I was in New York and was the marketing director of Fortune, we started something called the 50 Most Powerful Women in American Business, which still goes on in the magazine. So kind of a series kind of to go arm in arm with the CEO list, the Fortune 500 list. And anyway, during that time, too, she was the first woman ever to appear on the cover of Fortune, and with the headline saying, toughest babe in American business. And we just had the best time together, and interviewing Darla is tons of fun, and, you know, she just is so outspoken but so strong and has done so much for this state that I was really blown away by it.
Well, when the Darla Moore School was a business was announced at the old building where your daddy taught,
yep.
Governor Beasley was giving her the Order of the Palmetto. And David, who was a former student, was being a little bit sassy and said something about, well, I think we'll call it not a Palmetto lady, we'll call you a Palmetto babe. And she said, you better be careful, I may come back and run against you.
Well, she did say, and something I had read, that she had taken that cover of the magazine, that issue of the magazine, and looked at it and stuck it in a drawer and never looked at it again. So I asked if she had looked at it again, and she said that she's been cleaning out some and that she ran across it again and took a look. But I think she might have thrown it out.
Well, why don't you tell Darla's story, Rebecca?
Oh.
You did the interview.
Oh, yes. I'm trying to think what the best thing would be to tell about Darla. I can't quote everything that she said on radio. But, you know, I did ask her about her golf game because, you know, she and Condoleezza Rice were the two women that were initially asked to join Augusta National. And she had taken T. Boone Pickens down years before that, and he was a member of Augusta National, and he challenged her to get an eagle on, I think, hole number 11 or whatever it was. So I asked her, you know, had she ever gotten that eagle? And she didn't really answer that question, but she took off on T. Boone Pickens and had a few choice words to say about him.
Here's a young woman from Lake City who comes to the University of South Carolina. She did not major in business.
No, and that was something else that both of us had in common, that we went on to do something that we did not study. She very clearly knew that she wanted to find something to do that she would be able to support herself and live in a decent manner. And she also talks about having had a sixth sense when she was young that she was probably not going to stay, and you know, her life was going to be different. So she initially went to D.C. and worked with the Republican Party and found out that that was not going to pay her bills necessarily either, because, you know, every time an election comes along, you may be in or out. So she decided to go to New York, and that's where she started working on Wall Street, kind of made her mark in the world of bankruptcy, you know, and which nobody else wanted to have anything to do with.
I was going to say that was, she not only chose a career in a field where, again, it's male-dominated, but she went into bankruptcy, which nobody was touching.
Right, right.
And she made her name and her fortune.
And she wasn't afraid to speak her mind, but she, you know, really made her mark, married Richard Rainwater and then, you know, worked in that business. But I think what Darla likes to talk about most now is coming home and what she's done in Lake City. And she doesn't really like to talk about it. I mean, she's not trying to show off in any way. But I think that that's what she's incredibly proud of, is, you know, how she has really kind of turned that city around with Art Fields and putting it on the map. Education is incredibly important to her. And I think that one thing I noticed in all the things that she's done, also the Charleston Parks Conservancy, which I'm the beneficiary of, but she has always given a challenge with all of her gifts. So when she gave her first $25 million to the University of South Carolina, you know, a challenge was thrown out to the state. All along the way, the Parks Conservancy in Charleston is a public-private thing. It's, you know, it is not going to exist unless the community pitches in and helps, you know, physically gets out and digs dirt and plants flowers. And so the education thing is, I think, what is really, really important to her now, because she sees the state and all the opportunity that there is in this state. But if we don't have the people who can work or are sufficiently trained for the jobs that there are, then it's going to be for naught.
Well, you're absolutely right. And folks, of course, remember Darla Moore, School of Business at the University of South Carolina, but she's also given millions of dollars to Clemson
mm-hmm. where her
well.
Dad went.
Her dad went to Clemson.
Yeah.
Historically, looking back at people who have made it big from South Carolina, she probably is the most generous giving back to her state of anybody, certainly over the last 100 years. And as I pointed out to a former dean of the College of Business, she was a liberal arts major, as is the university's other largest donor, late Mr. McNair from Texas. Both were liberal arts majors. So I'm sorry, I just had to get that.
Well, I don't mind that commercial. I'm a liberal arts major, too, and I'm a big proponent of liberal arts education.
Okay. Rebecca, other than Darla, and she was, you know, on my list, too, who were some of the other individuals that really grabbed you as Amanda came up and said, this is who we're going to include?
Natalie Dupree is somebody I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Natalie is lives in Charleston, has, you know, her life has been about food and cookbooks, and she's just a wonderful person. But what struck me in her little interview was she talked about something called the pork chop theory. And I think it's so great about women and really when you think about it. She said, I have this thing called the pork chop theory. If one pork chop is in a pan, it goes dry. If two or more are in a pan, the fat from one feeds the other. So there's always room to move over for another woman. Think about it.
That's great.
Yeah. Pretty powerful. And I've been speaking quite a bit to groups of, you know, women about the book, and primarily, you know, if I'm in Texas, focusing on some of the Texas women in South Carolina. But that is a message that I think gets applause every time I mention it, because, you know, I think women are looking for support. They're looking for other people to, you know, kind of help have their backs. And that quote just says it all to me.
Well, and folks who think Natalie is just about fancy cooking, she's not. Her book on biscuits alone should tell you that. But there's a Shad Row Festival over in the PD, and they wanted her as a speaker. And initially, she was going to do it. Sadly, she could not. But in an exchange of emails with the people who are putting it on, they asked her, what part of the shad could she cook? And she could cook every part of the shad, and mentioned, by the way, boys, I cook mountain oysters too. So incredible sense of humor. But for her cooking, it can be anything. Okay, Amanda, you had the final choice. So give me your top three.
I think I can pull out. It's really hard, like you said, to pick a favorite, because so many of the women have great stories. But I was thinking about when Rebecca was talking about Natalie and moving over for other women. One of the women we interviewed was Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, and she grew up in Macon, Georgia, and she is the first female president and dean of Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. And she was the first Black woman in the United States to be named to lead a freestanding medical school. So she's obviously been a groundbreaker, but she's also dedicated her career to serving underserved communities, including women of color. And she said something much like Natalie talking about moving over for other women that really stuck with me. And she said, you know, for many years, I was the only Black person, you know, in the honors program in my school and so on as she went through her career. And she said, I never looked at it as an honor, though. Some people get confused. They begin to think they're special because they're only one of something. And she says, I think it's a problem if I'm the only one. And certainly that's what she's dedicated herself to, is pulling up other women and women of color along with her and creating those leadership opportunities for them. So that, you know, she sort of said, I tell my team, if not you, who is going to create those seats at the table? So I really appreciated that a lot. And then another one of my favorite interviews was Maya Freelon. She's a Durham, North Carolina artist. She does these big, beautiful, colorful tissue paper works. They've been in the Smithsonian and galleries all over the world. She's got a really interesting, I didn't even know this at the time when I picked her, but you know, her mother is this very talented musical artist. Her father was an architect. In fact, he was the architect that did the Smithsonian's African American Museum. And Maya, you know, talked about something that so many of the women brought up. We, you know, said, who are the Southern women in your life who've influenced you? And of course, so many people talked about mothers, yes, but grandmothers were really influential through, you know, the spectrum of women that we talked about. And she talked about, you know, the sacrifices of her ancestors. And, you know, she said something that, you know, made me think a lot about my grandmothers. And I grew up in upstate South Carolina, and they were, you know, textile mill workers. And she said, my grandmother would have been an artist if she could have. You know, she didn't have the means or resources or support. For her to see me do it, you know, gave her so much joy. And she constantly said, you see my hands, you see how they look, you see the scars, I did this for you, so do something. And so she really took that call to action, and the fact that her, you know, her ancestors had sacrificed to her to get her where she wants to be. And I think about my great-grandmother who couldn't read or write and worked in a, you know, started working in a cotton mill when she was 8, and the sacrifices that she made and others made so that I can read and write for a living.
That's a wonderful story. But I asked you for three.
Oh, three. Well, you know, I'll mention another South Carolina woman. You know, like I said, I grew up in upstate South Carolina, and Dorothy Allison is a wonderful writer and novelist from Greenville, South Carolina, and she wrote Bastard Out of Carolina. And just as a writer myself, I loved how she talked about putting a book together, and, you know, what she teaches her. She teaches other students writing now. I really loved what she said. She mentioned about evoking glory when she writes. And the interviewer asked her, you know, well, what does that mean, glory? And she said, glory is language on the page that doesn't just resonate, but evokes an immediate, emotionally tinged response in the listener or the reader. Glory does not require approval. Glory is like the angels take over and you're flying. And that just, every time I read that, you know, I had to read this book about 40 times in the proofing process. And every time I read that quote, the angels take over and you're flying, it always sent a chill up my spine.
Oh. All right. Elizabeth, I'm seeing a thread here, and I'm, you know, I want to talk about the grandmothers, but I just was curious about the impact of your grandmothers on you?
Well, you know, I think that my father's mother had a huge impact on me. She eloped with my grandfather when she was 18, and she wanted to go to architecture school, but the Depression kind of kicked in. But anyhow, my grandmother ended up working for her father in a lumber company that he owned, and over time, she ended up running the lumber company, and in the 50s, my father and his brother would drive lumber all the way up into New Jersey and New York. She had that big a business. She ran this company. She had two strokes, and she would go in a wheelchair, and we called the lumber company Heaven. And she was very tenacious, so everything that was thrown at her, she got up from, and she prevailed. And I think that strength in her came out in me and some of the things that I've been through. So she was a very powerful influence on what you can overcome and what you can do if you really believe in yourself. So she was a woman of substance before women were really working that hard. They said she could walk timber better than any man in Southwest Virginia. So my mother's mother, on the other hand, was the complete opposite. She was very prim and proper. And, you know, we ate Sunday dinners at noon, and every time we went to visit, our hands were held tight. And at my other grandmother's house, we could just go romp and do whatever we wanted.
that sounds like mine that I talk about in the book. Yes, I had the one that was very prim, very almost Victorian, you know, everything in the house was green. And, you know, we had the finger bowls at the table. And then Mama, my other grandmother, lived on the farm, and there were the chickens. And, yes, you could run around and have a great time with her. And I loved both of them. But I think, you know, what struck me as I was writing what I wrote was, you know, my mother also had a huge impact on me. But I think we're all kind of saying the same thing here, is that for us, every generation has gotten not better, but we've been able to progress further and further along. And that we had these, whether they were grandmothers or parents or whatever, who wanted the world to be better for all of us. And I find that kind of a message of hope in the book. You know, I said my teenage daughters, Lily and Say-Say, are my highest accomplishments. My hope is that I've been able to pass down the grit and grace that run through my family and so many others in the South, and that they see themselves reflected in these portraits of risk-taking, big-dreaming Southern women. I think they will. And I know, too, Dave DiBenedetto, our editor-in-chief, also talks a lot about his daughter and you know, how he has so much hope for what the future will be for his daughter and kind of breaking the mold. And so I think it's a kind of a thread that runs through.
Over the last 20 years, I have interviewed lots of people on this show, and I can't tell you the number of times that a grandparent comes up as the most influential person in an individual's life. At the top of the list would be Jonathan Green. Mm. But there are others. I'm a big gardener because my grandfather was a gardener. My daddy wouldn't know a cactus plant from a peach tree. And I'm talking about down to earth, when to plant, what to do. In Mobile, if people saw him working out in the yard, and he did have a helper, but if he was doing something, well, if Mr. Edgar's doing it, it's time for us to do it. But one thing I worry about in the 21st century is, as families get more dispersed, grandparents are there, but the daily contact that I had with my grandparents and you had is not happening now. The grandparents brought such a dimension to the table, whether it was discussion or whether it was teaching you how to plant or what have you. Am I being too melancholy there, Rebecca? Or is
No, I mean, I think the world has definitely changed. I would think that probably I'm not a grandmother, so I don't know, but I think that probably the grandmothers today feel like they are just as influential, but probably in a very different way. You know, it's probably much more likely than going to spend a month in North Carolina with my grandmother, like we did every summer, that they're probably FaceTiming every day. So, but
technology.
I think that technology has, you know, for better or for worse, has really keeps that connection up in a different way. But it is not so much sitting around the table having your Sunday meal.
My parents had a huge impact in my children's lives, but I was lucky enough that they lived 20 minutes from me. So I lived in the country, and when my children were really young, one would be in preschool and two would be too small to go, or And they spent a lot of time with my parents.
Okay. More stories from the book.
I wanted to mention Alison Glock. I mean, she is not featured in the book, but she wrote the foreword in the book, and she's done many of the really excellent pieces about women in Garden and Gun. And, you know, you have to remember when I started this, when Pierre Manigault and I started this and named the magazine Garden and Gun, it was because we wanted to do a magazine that was equally read by men and women, and the magazine truly is. But that's a delicate balance to make that happen. But anyway, so but where I was going with this is with Alison Glock. I wanted to just read something from a piece that she did several years ago in Garden and Gun. Because I love this quote from her, and I think you probably have some more, Amanda, from her from this book. But Southern women are not afraid to dance. Southern women know you can't outrun your past, that manners count, and that your mother deserves a phone call every Sunday. Southern women can say more with the cut of their eyes than a whole debates club worth of speeches. Southern women know the value of a stiff drink. But I love that kind of, you know, with the cut of their eyes. And I think we can, you know. I think it can knock somebody right down on the floor. Anyway, she's a beautiful writer, and she's done things for the magazine anywhere from going out turkey hunting and describing her experience doing that, and the Southern Women issue that we did about 10 years ago. And right. You probably have some choice words from Alison.
I do. She, as Rebecca mentioned, that first Southern Women feature we did, she wrote the introductory essay for, which she was reading from just now. And Alison says, you know, Alison has worked in national magazines for decades now, and she said that she got more reaction from that essay than she has any other thing that she's ever written. It just really struck a chord with people who said, yes, that's exactly what Southern women are like, or no, wait a minute, Southern women are not like that, you know. And so we knew that we wanted Alison to come back and write the foreword for the book. And in it, she sort of delves more deeply into what makes Southern women special. And, you know, certainly we talked about, you know, stereotypes. I hope that this book breaks stereotypes and shows that they're, you know, I think for so long in that larger consciousness, it was, you know, the Southern Belle. You know, in her introductory essay, she expands on this idea of the ties that bond Southern women. And she says, you know, regardless of where Southern women hail from in the region, they share a consciousness of certain truths, you know, a lean toward humor and humility and hard work, a tether, whether we like it or not, to the landscape, an impulse to give, a yearning for glory. She says, you know, we also carry in ourselves a brutal, burdensome history, an awareness of wrongs that can never be made right. We plant flowers anyway. And certainly that's not, you know, a dismissive note there at the end, but again, sort of calling back to that idea of resilience and determination, and a determination to, you know, find and look for beauty and making the best of things when life throws something at you.
Well, she used a phrase which I thought was very pertinent, our uncommon commonalities.
Right.
And what does she mean by that?
Well, to me, it means we have a shared history. As she said, it's a brutal, burdensome history in a lot of ways, but there's a shared history, and that, you know, depending on where you're from and your background, that you know, have to grapple with, some, you know, more so than others, but also shared traditions and a shared culture. And I think that, you know, as different as all the women are in this book, and certainly she talks about how, you know, Holly Hunter is not the same as Sandra Bullock, who is not Jesmyn Ward, who is not Octavia Spencer. There are these ties that bond Southern women. As you said, she says the granular particulars fade in the beam of those uncommon commonalities.
Well, and before that, the opening of that paragraph, where she says, Southern women identify as Southern women, and whether that means drinking sweet tea or lassoing bucks or walking barefoot in sun-dappled hollers or graduating summa cum laude from Spelman or galloping thoroughbreds across a carpet of bluegrass or dancing at a cotillion or sweating over a low country boil or singing soul-swelling gospel in church, the imprint of Southernness remains. I think that's very powerful. To me, one of the things this book did, Southern women is not class or race or education. It's across the board. 20 years ago, if you talked about Southern women, you were talking about white Southern women, and usually we're talking about upper class or upper middle class white Southern women. This book cuts across class lines, which still exist in the South, even if we don't want to admit that they do. And that's where I wonder if people would say, well, why did you include so-and-so? Is she really a Southern woman? Have you come across anything like that? I mean,
you know, I think that what you mentioned is something that Garden and Gun has tried to show. You know, the South is not a monolith, and Garden and Gun has, I think, done a really great job of showing all the many ways that you can be Southern and how Southern culture has thrived and the people trying to make the South a better place, and has helped break some of those stereotypes. And that's certainly what we wanted to do with the book, too, is to broaden people's minds about what it means to be a Southern woman, but also by sharing perspectives from people with incredibly different backgrounds. You know, they all share wisdom. There's something to be gained when you hear people's stories. That's certainly why we want to be journalists and storytellers, because when you learn more about the world, you can be more empathetic. I think when you, even if someone has a completely different life experience from you, and certainly there are many women in the book who have had different life experiences from me. I mean, I feel like I learned something from each of them. So, you know, hopefully we are cataloging, you know, Southern women of the past and the present, but it's, you know, also you're talking about future generations to also create something that future generations can read and learn about, you know, what life was like at this particular point in time. And that's certainly, too, we partnered with Girls, Inc., the organization, and we're donating a portion of the proceeds of the book to Girls, Inc.
Please explain what that is.
Well, Girls, Inc. is a national organization that works with underprivileged children primarily to help expose them to the business world. They have mentor kind of activities. They're really, you know, trying to make life better for young girls who are living in difficult situations. I don't remember all of the statistics, but it's working too. And that was part of our decision to work with them, was because it was an organization that was really having an impact.
All right. Well, Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign, and so I'm going to go around the table and ask for any last words. And Elizabeth Lanier Fennell, I'm going to start with you.
I think the underlying theme of this book and what comes up in every story you read has certain words in it. It's grit, it's character, it's nurturing, it's passion, it's respect. I think that this is a collection of very proud women who have not been afraid to step out of the box and pursue their passions and their dreams, and have done well doing it. And Southern women are a community of women you learn from and you gather wisdom from. And we all take that wisdom and pass it on to the next generation. And we certainly emulate, I know I emulate things that my mother did, and I don't even think about it until later. I go, wow, that was my mom and or my grandmother. And I just think that it's a wonderful portrayal that does break down a lot of the stereotypes, and there's some really hilarious stories in there. Yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
I think that's a good point. There are funny stories as well as very serious stories, yeah, I guess.
Sure.
It
covers it all.
Yeah. All right. Rebecca Wesson-Darwin?
Well, in sitting here and listening to this, I'm sitting here thinking, when are we going to do the next one? Because I think, you know, trying to pick the 100 or so women that are in here, it just shows that there's so many more stories out there like that. I can't tell you the number of people who have come to me and said, I bought the book, and then I've given it to my 3 grandchildren or to my daughters or to my husband. men can read this book, too. But I think that, you know, we've really started something very good here, because it's not, you know, if you were thinking, oh, I'm going to buy this book on Southern women, and I bet so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so are in here, it is not that list of people. There are some of those people. But I think the unexpectedness of it and the celebrating of people who are not necessarily a household name is really what makes it great. And I do think that, you know, 10 years from now, maybe sooner, there'll be a need to do another one, because the world will continue to evolve and the story will continue to need to be told, I'm sure.
All right. and Amanda Heckert.
I think, you know, one of the most gratifying things to me has been hearing the reaction, certainly from the women in the book. I've received such nice notes and emails. You know, we mentioned Minnie Lou Bradley. She wrote me, you know, on her Bradley 3 Ranch station area, a note about how much it meant to her to see her story there, along with, as Rebecca said, some of these maybe more household names. And but also from people who have read the book. Number one, you know, that it's made them rethink what it means to be a Southern woman. My best friend gave it to one of her coworkers, and her coworker came back and said, "Thank you so much for giving me this book. It's made me more comfortable with calling myself a Southern woman," which I thought was an interesting reaction. But it was because we did tell so many different stories about what it means to be a Southern woman. It also, I think, has inspired, you know, some people to record the stories in their own families. I've heard that reaction. Like, I love that, you know, this is a record of what these women went through, and I wish that, you know, someone had written down the stories of the women in my family. And it's, so it's inspired some people, too, to make sure that those stories live on in their own lives.
That, for those of us who do Southern history, that is what I would hope others would pursue. Thank you. All right. Elizabeth Lanier Fennell, Rebecca Wesson-Darvin, and Amanda Heckert, thank you all so much for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you,
Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Having these three women on the program to discuss the book Southern Women, More Than 100 Stories of Innovators, Artists, and Icons was a real treat. The importance of grandmothers, struggle, resilience, what women across class and race have in common. It's not just a book for women only. It's a book for all Southerners and all South Carolinians, and a number of South Carolina women get their due. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.